Hello and welcome to episode 44 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. Once again, I am that bored man and my name is Graham Lee. The title I'm going to use for this episode is We Would Know What They Thought When They Did It. And that is the title of an essay or paper by Richard Hamming, the information theorist who came up with Hamming coding, amongst other things. And the title uses the subjunctive mood, so the sort of conditional idea in the English language, which isn't a mood or tense that is very common in modern English parliaments. So in saying we would know what they thought when they did it, what Hamming means is we would like to know what they thought when they did it. It should be that we know what they thought when they did it. He's asking for a history of computing, and not a history in what he sees as the traditional sense of a history, in that, you know, the lists of dates and famous people who came up with ideas, because that history is flawed. The history of the kings and queens of Britain, or of the presidents of the United States of America, misses out a lot of important information. You know, yes, these people have key roles in society and they make momentous decisions, but they probably weren't the people who came up with those decisions. There was a wealth of information that went into making those decisions. When Henry VIII dissolved the monasteries, we're often told that it's about not being able to get his marriage annulled by the Pope. But what else went into it? You know, why was that that particular outcome so important? Or why was that that outcome that he removed the church in England from the Catholic Church, the way that he went about achieving this aim? What else went into that idea? And of course, like some examples of ideas end up attributed to the wrong person, because the person who either propagates the idea wasn't the person who invented it, or the person who invented the idea wasn't the person who propagated it, or it was invented multiple times and only stuck one of those times. We think about the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA, which is of course attributed to Watson and Crick, but they didn't do the work that actually uncovered that structure. They did contribute to deriving the structure of the DNA molecule. Or we think of the theory of evolution, which had sort of multiple progenitors, of whom the most famous is, of course, Charles Darwin. But what Hamming says in his request for a different theory of computing, or sorry, a different history of computing, is it has been said that if you want to master a field, then you should go to the masters and avoid the commentators. So what he's saying is, let's find the people who actually made the decisions, and let's ask what they were thinking. Let's find out what went into those decisions. Let's not look to the way that they were propagated and the way that they became mainstream. And I think that's a really interesting framing of the history of computing, and one that leads us to realize that computing makes very inefficient progress, that a lot of ideas are misunderstood, or are misinterpreted, or are like willfully interpreted in a different way in order to gain market benefits or mindshare benefits, and that this leads to an overall retardation of the rate of progress of ideas, of development, of of our craft and of our discipline. So look at some ideas. and some examples. So there are situations in which we cannot do that. We cannot go to the masters. Of course, like, we can identify many parts of the field in which the masters have died and in which they were working under conditions of secrecy. So, you know, we think of Alan Turing and his contributions to not just like the theoretical development of computing, which of course he published, but to the practical electronic engineering of computers, first at Bletchley Park and then at Manchester University. He, of course, is dead. Many of his collaborators are as well. And a lot of that history is attributed to him when, in fact, it's, you know, other electrical engineers like Flowers and Tutt who did a lot of the work, and unnamed female computers, you know, mathematicians, who did the programming, the wiring up, the interpretation of the results of these computers. But there are even examples where the, you know, where we're a lot closer to the genesis of the idea in history and just can't pin it down because nobody was asking, right, who are the masters? Everybody was reading the commentators. For example, there's a thread on Twitter where Laurent Bossovit, who published The Leprechauns of Software Engineering, which is a great book that I'm going to pause the podcast recording now so that I remember to write in the show notes that you should go and check it out. It's rare that I do that, by the way. What normally happens is that I say, oh yes, I'll put a link in the show notes, and then I forget to do that, and, you know, everybody is disappointed. Laurent Bossovit is looking for the genesis of the phrase legacy code. Now, we probably all have an idea of what we think we mean by legacy code, and we probably all assume that if somebody else uses the phrase legacy code, that we would mean the same thing that they mean by it. Who came up with the idea, and why did they come up with that idea? Were they framing legacy code as this, you know, disappointingly bad thing that you did in the past that you now know is a mistake and you want to, like, atone for? Or did they mean legacy in, you know, the typical positive sense in which it's used throughout the rest of the English language? You know, one's legacy is the things that one is remembered for down through history. Well, we don't know. We don't actually know who came up with this term. We don't know how it entered popular parlance. Bossovit couldn't find it. I had a look. I couldn't find it. What I could find was books and magazines from fairly early in the 1990s, definitely 94, sort of November 1993, I think was the earliest, where people were already using legacy code as meaning the old version of the product that you wish to replace with modern technology. But they weren't doing many of the things that indicate that it's a neologism even. They weren't doing quotes around legacy code. They weren't explaining the phrase legacy code when it arrived in their text. So already by the end of like 93, we can see that legacy code was an established term with an established meaning. We don't know how that meaning was established or by whom. There is a guess that it is due to the Eric S. Raymond updated version of the Hacker's Jargon Dictionary. Actually, the phrase legacy code, the word legacy, doesn't appear in the glossary for the jargon file, not even the Eric Raymond updated version. So, you know, that appears, either it's been deleted in the intervening time between, you know, 93-ish and now, or that is a false etymology and that it doesn't appear in the jargon file. Even if it did appear in a jargon file, would that be because Eric Raymond invented the term and added it to the file? It's definitely not in the previous published versions of the Jargon File? Is it because he had heard the term used and wanted to add it as something that he thought was in common parlance, or something that he thought should be in common parlance? Again, we don't know. So we don't know where this idea of legacy code comes from and how it arrived at its current form. There are situations where, unlike legacy code, where the origin is lost to history, there are examples where we can see the ideas drift, where we know at least that what they thought when they did it is not what people think when they refer to it now. And it can be hard to sort of tie down the reason for that and to understand what led to that change, who did the changing, and what was the motivation behind that change. So, for example, technical debt is a phrase that appears in a passing way in a very short object-oriented programming experience report by Ward Cunningham, who's one of the Tektronix's small talk programmers, created the wiki, created the class responsibility collaboration design card, signed the Agile Software Manifesto. Definitely someone who was an important figure in not only sort of technical development, but also thinking about technical development in sort of the early 90s. In March 26th, 1992, he wrote this experience report of the YCASH portfolio management system, which is basically an object-oriented, small talk system for helping, do accounting. In fact, it says here, basic accounting, record keeping and reporting, as well as analytical computations to assist the manager of cash portfolios. So this is a tool for finance people. He talks about a serious pitfall that they discovered in their experience of developing this system is a failure to consolidate. Although immature code may work fine and be completely acceptable to the customer, excess quantities will make a program unmasterable, leading to extreme specialization of programmers and finally an inflexible product. Shipping first-time code is like going into debt. A little debt speeds development, so long as it is paid back promptly with a rewrite. Objects make the cost of this transaction tolerable. The danger occurs when the debt is not repaid. Every minute spent on not quite right code counts as interest on that debt. Entire engineering organizations can be brought to a standstill under the debt load of an unconsolidated implementation, object-oriented or otherwise. So what we see here is that in working on a tool for doing management of cash securities, i.e. talking to people who know exactly what debt is, Ward Cunningham introduced the idea of debt into the engineering of object-oriented software. He says every minute spent on not quite right code counts as interest on that debt. So we've got this idea that, yes, you get somewhere quickly if you do the thing that you think of on your first understanding, but you had better very quickly go back and improve it based on what you subsequently learn, and presumably be continually improving it. This idea of consolidating the implementation, i.e. sort of bringing everything you've done together. He's talking about extreme specialization of programmers. So once a program that, while acceptable to the customer, is also masterable, which sounds like, and I'm trying not to put words into Ward's mouth here, I'm trying to say this is my interpretation of this, He's saying that any one person should be able to understand any part of this project, and that if you have specialization, in fact, we go back. Each member of our small engineering team maintains at least general knowledge of all aspects of the roughly 4 megabytes of source code. This includes some libraries provided by the vendor and others written to our specification by third-party contractors. Mature sections of the program have been revised or rewritten many times, providing the consolidation that is key to understanding and continued incremental development. So we're hearing that there is frequent rewriting, there is like frequent consolidation, understanding of how ideas and expectations have moved on, and rewriting the software to reflect the state of the art of the understanding of the system, and that this is done by members of the team across not only their own code but vendor code and contractor code as well. Technical debt isn't a thing that you deliberately do. You don't like deliberately add bad code in order to get quicker to market. You add code that gets you quickly to market, and that counts as technical debt at the moment that you do it. So we understand that there is a difference between how the phrase is used now and how it was used when Ward introduced this term in 1992, and we don't necessarily see whether it was willful or accidental misunderstanding or some other reason that caused this change in meaning, this drift. Another famous example is, of course, Alan Kay, who says, I can tell you that I invented the term object-oriented programming and I did not have the C++ language in mind, or words to that effect. Well, we have his word that he invented the phrase object-oriented programming, and I'm happy to take him at that word. But of course, he was working on a team at Xerox PARC with a lot of other people. He may have invented the term object-oriented programming, but how much of object-oriented programming did he invent? The history he shows in the talk that this comes from, again, link in show notes, is fairly compelling and gives the idea that, like, you know, that he took these ideas and brought them together. So he does cite some other people, but like, who else contributed on that team that he worked with? Did they all have the same idea of object-oriented programming in mind? When was it decided? Because C++ comes from the 1980s, and like definitely after the introduction of Smalltalk as a like commercially viable programming language. Who decided that C++, which he is complaining about here, was object-oriented? Was it Bjarne Stroustrup? Was it programmers at AT&T? Was it people out in the community? Because both Smalltalk and C++ borrow ideas from the Simula programming language, which provides facilities for modeling real-world objects in the programming environment, in the software, but doesn't use the phrase object-oriented. So when Alan Kay used the phrase object-oriented programming, was he describing something that is in Simula or not? Did the people who did the Simula work have the same ideas when it comes to modeling real-world entities in the software world that he was having? Was his use of the phrase and his genesis of this phrase, object-oriented programming, was that itself a form of conceptual drift? And what were the similar people doing? And did Smalltalk successfully encapsulate, if you'll pardon the pun, those ideas? Did they get rediscovered later? Did they get lost? Final example where we see the drift. The idea of software craftsmanship comes from a book by Pete McBreen called Software Craftsmanship, The New Imperative. It is a very good book. It is a reasonably short book. If you genuinely want a short book by Pete McBreen, then you should probably read his book on questioning extreme programming. But if you don't mind one that's like 15 pages or so longer, then Software Craftsmanship, A New Imperative is a good work. And in the Software Craftsmanship book, he talks about the guild system. He talks about the idea that we don't actually know how to do programming well, and we don't know how to transfer the knowledge of how to do programming well. And so we should have a sort of hierarchical apprenticeship model where master craftsmen like work with pretty good craftsmen, you know, with sort of journeyman programmers, who then also work with apprentice programmers in something that's a bit like a sort of chief programmer model team. So the master craftsman takes ultimate responsibility, but farms bits out, you know, down the hierarchy, as it were, so that it's actually like the apprentices doing all of the grunt work, a sort of academic model where the DPhils or PhDs do all of the research and professors get all of the awards. It talks about people putting their name to their software products, you know, signing them in the same way that like artists sign their work. And he talks about software as an art form rather than as an engineering discipline, because this book is situated at a moment when software engineering was coming in for a lot of criticism for having sort of perpetuated rather than solved the software crisis. Software craftsmanship now is this sort of, you know, post-agile, agilier than thou manifesto, which talks about you know, raising the bar and a community of professionals, but which doesn't actually have any sort of like actionable ideas, and it doesn't seem to have like instituted a programmer's guild or an apprenticeship system, or well, there are like internships at Eighth Light, but is that really like the way that you build this, you know, distributed craft model where people put their name to their code? Of all of the people who work in craftsmanship companies such as Eighth Light, can anyone sort of show their masterpieces, their works of art, or is it still all being done behind non-disclosure agreements and copyright licenses and end-user license agreements, and being done in secret, and thus not implementing the idea of software craftsmanship? So the idea has drifted, and we know what the person, we know what they were thinking when they did it, because Pete McBreen did it and wrote it down. But now the idea, or rather the name for the idea, has come to reflect a different set of ideas, one that has fewer sort of specific prescriptions for what we should do or how we should do it. There are further examples where you kind of get this like weird spidey sense that there has been a drift in the like meaning of the phrase or in the ideas encapsulated in a term, but it's not kind of clear when or why. And I think there's an archetypal example in agile software development, which of course is like a 2-decade-old idea now, and even at the time that it was created, was an idea with many sort of progenitors. Like the number of signatories on the Agile Alliance is fair. The Agile Manifesto is fairly large. Maybe each of these people had a different idea in mind. In fact, that almost certainly is what happened. They were looking for a sort of combining call for the ideas that they'd all had in like their different methodologies and their different approaches to writing software in a lightweight fashion. They weren't trying to like consolidate all of this into a single unified idea. Now compare that with, say, the Three Amigos, Butch, Rumbaugh, and Jakobson, who like identified that they were all basically doing object-oriented design, all basically in more or less the same way, with like slightly different terminologies or like different shapes on their diagrams, or different like things focused in their diagrams and backgrounded, and so brought all of that together and created a shared methodology, object-oriented analysis and design, and a shared language, the unified modeling language, with that word unified in it, much as like more or less the same people, or at least their colleagues, did with the rational unified process. They took these ideas of like iterative and incremental software methodology and just went, let's all sell the same methodology, let's unify this thing. That's not what the agile software development people were doing. There isn't a unified XP, Scrum, Crystal, DSDM, whatever else, rapid application development and so on. There isn't a single unified methodology that came out of this. There was a sort of abstract set of things to value and principles to abide by so that you embed those values in your work, but there isn't a single shared idea. It is therefore no surprise to find drift in the meaning of agile software development, because there wasn't a single meaning to start with. But we see it happen again later on with DevOps. DevOps definitely means a very similar thing to agile when we look at sort of some of the progenitor texts. You know, we look at things like the Phoenix Project, which, okay, is an amplification text rather than a progenitor text. Things like Accelerate. We see this idea that DevOps is about orienting your entire software effort behind a single shared purpose and a shared understanding of the goals. Your development and your operations are all trying to create and operate a software system that works for the benefit of its customers. But now you can get a job in DevOps, and that's not a developer, and it's not a sysadmin. So we've got developers, we've got operations, and we've got DevOps as a separate role, as a as a division of labor. And that is clearly the exact opposite of what is implied at the genesis of this idea. So again, it has drifted. It has become this new thing where the same word is used and it means something entirely different. How did that happen? We would know what they thought when they did it. Now, I'm suggesting that this problem of idea drift and its root cause, which is not understanding the ideas at the moment of introduction, and not understanding the ideas as they were introduced at later times, is actually slowing down development of software engineering. We have neutral drift, to use an evolutionary term, where the whole swathes of fields will go, okay, we need to use that technology because it's better than this technology, or we need to use that method because it's better than this method, but without understanding what the first method was and what it was trying to achieve, and whether it is being used in a way that can achieve that thing, so that the new idea can actually be sort of fairly, and to the extent that it's possible, objectively compared against the original one. So, object-oriented programming doesn't help you reason about mutable state, therefore you have to use functional programming. Actually, object-oriented programming does let you reason about mutable state. The entire point, to some extent, of object-oriented design is encapsulation. It is to break a big computer program, such as being done with structured programming, into a lot of small, independent computer programs that communicate by sending messages so that you don't have as much mutable state to worry about in any one part of the program, and you can understand it. This is taken to an extreme with design by contract. I have an article from the online magazine De Programmatica Ipsum, i.e. on the programming itself, about how OOP is designed to help you reason about mutable state. Nonetheless, people will say, well, you have to abandon all of the tools and all of the thought processes that go into applying those tools that you have learned so far and learn this different set of tools because it is impossible to do the thing with your existing mindset that mindset and that set of tools was actually created to do. This seems like it is leading us at least down off into a tangent, if not into a dead end or on a wild goose chase. Now, we also realise that, you know, if people are saying this now, that like functional programming helps you to do the thing that OOP was actually designed to do, they're saying it in 2021, when object-oriented programming was sort of developed in secret in the through the 1970s and like announced and shared in the 1980s. This is very unlikely that any of the people who are saying that it can't do what it sets out to do were involved in that. Like, I certainly wasn't. You know, I'm knocking on 40 now, which means that the Smalltalk 80 existed and, you know, pretty much was published by the time that I was born. So, you know, all I'm giving you is secondhand knowledge, but secondhand knowledge where I've at least gone back to the texts and the interviews. There are some really good oral histories of computing from the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California, where they just interview like these people, you know, the people who invented spreadsheets or Smalltalk or, you know, particular models of computer or whatever. And just say, like, what was going on? How did this come about? I can use that source material to synthesize an idea of what seemed to be going on, but I still, wasn't there, and that is still an incomplete source of information. But in many contexts in computing, I am not doing that, and in general, software engineers formulate their ideas and carry out their work without reference to that kind of synthesis or analysis. So we get ideas that come and then decades later get rejected and go without asking, well, what was it that was happening? You know, how do we situate that event in history? I see it with Agile at the moment. You know, people say, well, Agile processes like Scrum have a lot of ceremony, a lot of overhead, there's too much communication. Like, I can't understand why anybody would work this way. When they were created to control the overall level of communication and overhead and document production that was being done in earlier approaches to software product development. So, this raises the question, either what has gone wrong or what has improved to the point where even the Agile processes are now too heavyweight, or what was it that they were trying to achieve and is that problem still relevant now? So we find that the problem also affects new ideas. Not just the rejection of the old ideas, but the incomplete adoption of the new ideas, where because they become fads, people adopt them and then integrate them into their existing way of working so that they can claim to be doing the new thing. They don't become justified interventions and improvements that result in complete change. I often point, when people ask me about OOP and like why I'm so sort of, you know, fixated on this idea of, you know, defending this dying way of doing software development. I point to all of the literature from the 80s and the 90s that talks about object-oriented analysis, design, project management, economics in the case of Brad Cox's book. Like the idea of object-oriented programming wasn't you carry on doing what you do, only you put a dot in between a data structure and a function call. It was you change the way that you run your software company, and by the way that the programmers change what they do is called object-oriented programming. But you were meant to change your management, your client engagement, your testing, your deployment, the whole thing was object-oriented. And that didn't happen because it was easier just to adopt the tools and then say that you were done. If we look at the way that many Java programs were written at the outset, and you know, maybe even today, there's not a whole lot of object orientation going on. There's, you know, static methods all over the place, which are basically just namespaced functions. Static variables. If you have static variables and static methods, then what you have is like namespace modules that have some level of data protection, but you don't have active objects. You don't have separate computer programs running in your computer program that communicate by sending messages. So, you know, is this happening with functional programming now? Are people actually adopting the ideas of functional programming, or are they adopting languages that have closures and then pretending that closures are actually functions rather than, mutable state capture and objects? So I believe that we need more oral histories. We need more sharing of ideas as they develop. And that includes a history of those ideas. So it includes going back to ideas that are in development now and say, well, what was the process of development? Why was this suggested as an intervention? Why did it gain popularity and adoption? Did it stay the same as it was adopted, or did it mutate? In its mutated form, does it address the problem that it was setting out to address? In other words, we would know what they thought when they did it. As ever, very happy to hear feedback on this episode or on any of the podcasts that you've heard. You can email me, GrahamLee@acm.org. You can find me on Twitter, iwasleeg, IwasLeeg. Thank you very much for listening. Take care. I will talk to you again soon.